Bat Segundo here, and I haven't slept in days. But thankfully, this Ritalin prescription I stole from my 6-year-old cousin has kept me wide awake. But I'm determined to cure my insomnia. Recently, I visited my local video store in an effort to rent some porn. But it seems that a certain 16-year-old clerk has 86'd me from the place. It seems that there was a certain misunderstanding involving that curtain you have to slide when you walk into the back room. Due to reasons I won't go into, my fly was undone, and I had tried to zip it up. My attempt was reasonable but unsuccessful, and the zipper got caught in the curtain. Now this clerk seems to think that I was exposing myself, and I'll be at the courthouse tomorrow morning contesting these charges. But in the meantime, I've borrowed a few VHS tapes from Jorge. He's turned me on to some Sharon Stone movies, specifically Basic Instinct and Sliver, which contain various glimpses of Miss Stone's anatomy that I hope to use for my enjoyment. They were apparently far more compelling than Basic Instinct 2, so Jorge tells me. Now, I had thought that Sharon Stone had made up all the dialogue on the spot, but it seems that I was wrong. A man named Joe Esterhaus is responsible for writing it all. In what form? Who can say? Unfortunately, our young living correspondent, being so outright square, failed to ask him how it all went down. I'm hoping to take this dignified blackguard to the strip club very, very soon. Now, if you'll excuse me, I have a fine little film called Showgirls to watch, which comes, highly recommended, from Jorge.
So I'm here with Joe Esterhaus, author of The Devil's Guide to Hollywood. Joe, how are you doing?
I'm good, Ed. Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Oh, great. Now, I actually was wondering, because it was The Devil's Guide, I was wondering if you were kind of contemplating Ambrose Bierce's The Devil's Dictionary.
Absolutely.
You were writing about.
Absolutely. I've always been a big Bierce fan. Of course, he's pretty well out of print today, and a lot of young people don't even know who he is. But I always loved that kind of dark, mordant wit that that he had. I read The Devil's Dictionary when I was a young man, and was struck by it and laughed. And thought it was a wonderful original piece of writing. And then, of course, I read more Bierce, read the Civil War sketches, and thought it was a very interesting and strange writer. And the Civil War sketches almost verge on Poe, you know, and they're almost horror stories in some ways. And, I mean, a very, very original writer, I think.
Well, Bierce also started off, like you, in journalism.
Yes, he did at the Chronicle, the Examiner one, yeah.
Yeah.
And he also is the character in The Old Gringo, is he not?
I think so.
Yeah,
but he was also known as the wickedest man in San Francisco,
really?
Too. Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
No wonder I picked him.
Well, anyway, let's go to the book here. All the chapters in this book.
Incidentally, let me just point out before we go that the subtitle of this book is The Screenwriter is God, and it is equally important because, of course, as you know, screenwriters have always been second-class citizens through the years, and that subtitle is a kind of a middle finger extended to the sky at the Hollywood establishment, so I take great pride in it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it also could also be misinterpreted the other way, as sort of like, hey, you're just a lowly screenwriter. What are you doing proclaiming yourself as God?
Well, but no one's ever done that, so
okay.
I take pleasure in doing it.
Yeah, sure. We could all use some more gods.
That's right.
Well, all the chapters in this book have exclamation points, and I'm wondering why you included this. I mean, doesn't a statement like you're a jackass in the hailstorm, doesn't that stand on its own 2 feet without the exclamation point?
Well, it's a kind of a parody, you know. I mean, in one part of this book, I think, is a send-up of how two books, especially screenwriting how-to books, because most of the screenwriting how-to books out there have been written by non-screenwriters or people who have some, you know, had one movie made, like the great guru of screenwriting, Robert McKee. So this advice, this profound advice, and the lessons that are in each chapter, I think, especially ones like, you know, steal all the memorabilia from the set that you can before the actors do. There are some things that just naturally demand exclamation marks, and that's why I do that.
Gotcha. Well, I was speaking of Robert McKee. You don't exactly speak pleasantly of him. I was wondering about the all hail sidebars and all of the general format of the book was vaguely reminiscent of a PowerPoint presentation. I was wondering if you intended to like take this on the road like McKee and have this sort of competing seminar.
McKee is ideal to do it because he's an actor, and as an actor, I gather he was a very good actor. He's an actor playing a part of the screenwriter, like Hal Holbrook plays Mark Twain each night. I'm a writer. What I'm good at is sitting on my butt. You know, the word German word, Sitzfleisch, the strength to sit on your butt, the key to any kind of writing, I think. And that's what I enjoy doing. I don't see myself acting and going out there on the road. Thank you.
Well, okay.
Although what I'm doing now, in terms of publicizing a book, I don't know if you know Dante's definition of hell for a writer. But it is that the writer is doomed for all eternity to reread what he's written. Well, it seems to me that a publicity tour takes it to the next step and is worse, because the writer is doomed for months and months to talk about what he's written, and I think that's one step worse.
Oh, gotcha. Well, I actually wanted to ask you about something that you mentioned in the author's note in American Rhapsody, where you described the twisted little man inside me who used a different typeface to sort of represent this man when you were writing about Bill Clinton. And you note that he was the guy who wrote Basic Instinct, Showgirls, Silver, and Jade. Now, how can we be sure that this homunculus isn't in this book here?
Oh, this homunculus absolutely is all over this book. You're absolutely right. That's very perceptive of you. I think he wrote most of this book. I took channeling and dictation from this little dick. Who's caused me so many problems through the years, but he and I have reached a fragile coexistence and an uneasy peace. Periodically, I have to give him his way. He just demands to come out, and I think he demanded here. Smashed, twisted, gouged, came out, and once again made himself known before the public.
Hmm. Well, do you think that a guy like that is necessary to write about screenwriting?
He is for me, certainly.
Yeah.
I think he's an ideal twisted little person to write about screenwriting because he has a surreal, absurdist view. He is a very cynical little creature. All ideal qualities to write about Hollywood and screenwriting. Mm.
You mentioned, I know, at one point about cynics, that you can't be a complete cynic in Hollywood. I think you were, I can't remember if you were quoting Ben Hecht or someone else, but you noted basically that you can't be a total cynic, but it helps to be cynical in working in Hollywood. Do you need to, what's the sort of healthy level of cynicism you have to make it as a screenwriter?
The cynicism cannot extend to your belief in your own writing and to your own work. I think one of the things that happens with screenwriters, because they are usually embarrassed and they wind up in many cases selling out what they've written themselves at the behest of others, is that they become so cynical about all of it, including their own work, that, as Bill Goldman says, it becomes all about the job. My issue with Goldman exactly is that his cynicism, in his approach to writing, is so overwhelming that he negates whatever conscience or passion or strength there may be in screenwriting. And he says, essentially, you do a gig. He tells this amazing anecdote in one of his books where he's sitting with a producer, and the producer is coming up with thoughts that Bill himself feels are moronic thoughts. That's how he describes them. But what he does is he writes these moronic ideas down and pretends to be really interested and pretends that he really likes them just so he'll be hired for the project. Well, I don't think that's writing. I think that's hooking, and that's essentially what I say in the book.
But how can one have strength and conscience and integrity when the entire industry is driven by money? You actually admit in the book that you wrote Basic Instinct to make, basically to outdo Shane Black's $3 million or his deal. You wanted to outdo him because you had set the previous record. You wanted to beat his record, and that was a completely commercial movie.
That was certainly one reason that I wrote it. There were others. But, I think that book publishing, and I've written 5 books at this point, is equally cynical in the sense that book publishers want to make money. The reason I'm out here on the road flogging this beast is because by contract I have to do it, and they want to make money. Back in the day, writers could write something. Look, Faulkner wrote things in longhand on brown envelope pieces, sent them into to his editor, that was it until the book came out, and he was informed how it did. Well, that was really back in the day. You know, the world has completely changed. I don't think just because you are working in a form where the entity wants to make money, whether that's in movies or in book publishing, that you necessarily have to write things solely to make money. It's possible, I think, to have a commercially successful piece, commercially accessible piece, that also says something and that's about something. Now, sometimes those work and sometimes they fail. You know, I did a movie called Fist about the labor movement in the 30s and 40s. That I had high hopes for, and so did the director, Norman Jewison, in the studio. And Jewison specialized in directing the kind of movie that was commercially accessible, but that also was about something. Movie came out, disaster, died. You know, so you never know whether something is going to be successful or not commercially. My advice to the writer, to the screenwriter certainly, is don't worry about how it's going to do commercially. If you have a thought, or if there's a subject that fascinates you, or if a character fascinates you, or you have a story in mind, just write it, whether you think it'll be a hit or not. George Lucas is the only person I know who seems to be on the money a lot in terms of what's going to be a hit movie or not. Put it out there and see what happens. Jagged Edge was a little dark thriller that the studio had no faith in. The ad budget one behind it was minuscule, we took it to the Toronto Film Festival. It won the Audience Award in Toronto, and from there on it went out and it got really mixed reviews, mixed at best, and it went out there and was the number one movie in the country for something like 6 weeks. Flashdance, the studio had so little faith in that they sold off 40% of their profit to a private investor group. It went out, and God knows, for 3 months the movie was raging. Fist, on the other hand, came out and went down. Showgirls came out and disastrous in its first weekend. So, you never know. You just, basic instinct, faced, the very, very serious protests, and there was a gigantic uproar. Nobody knew what that was going to mean. After the first Friday night opening, the protest essentially disappeared because the people came out and didn't understand what the protesting was about. And the movie went on and became the hit movie of 1992, what a French magazine called not just the cinematic event of the year, but believe it or not, the world event of the year. Of course, the French are cineast crazy and hyperbolic, but still, I take some pleasure, rueful pleasure, wicked and malicious pleasure out of the fact that that Basic was the world event of 1992 in someone's eyes.
Yeah. But going back to this issue of Jagged Edge, for example, you note in the book that Jeff Bridges had a string of like unsuccessful movies, right. And then with this one, he sort of hit. And you also pointed out in that same segment that a lot of other stars, flash and burn essentially after a hit movie. Since there's such a kind of, I mean, how can one really honestly gauge and predict the commercial potential of a screenplay? I mean, is it truly sort of possible to do that?
No, it's not. That's exactly my point. It's not. Absolutely not. You never know. That's why I say to screenwriters, just write what you know. Write what's close to you. Write what's in your brain or in your gut. Write what's something that really interests you. And don't worry about how it's going to do, whether it's going to be a hit or not. You don't have any control over it anyway.
Well, I actually wanted to remark upon some of the idiosyncratic methods you have in terms that deviate a bit from the norm. You urge writers, for example, to take their wives to meetings. You suggest not living in Los Angeles. Now, I'm wondering, as a commercially successful screenwriter yourself, is this an effort to sort of mislead the competition a bit, or are these actually legitimate?
No, I absolutely. Naomi comes to all my meetings with me. Yeah. And the reason for that is because I think she's one of the smartest people that I met. And I want her take, whether it's with a studio executive or a book publisher, I want to see, or an editor, I want her take. She's smart enough to gauge material, and actually so good at it that the fact that Telling Lies in America was made, and got terrific reviews and was invited into the New York Film Festival, one of two American movies that year, was because Naomi went through a script that I'd written 10 years before, found where it was flawed, encouraged me to rewrite it. I did, and then the movie really worked on screen. I'm proud of it. So I have great respect for her. She's my partner and my ally. And it seems to me that if we are lucky in life to have those kinds of partners and allies, then we should take advantage of that, you know, and really lean on them for advice, and I do.
And this hasn't been any problem with any sort of executive saying, what are you doing, bringing your wife?
In the beginning, they were really startled. I mean, I remember I remember a meeting with Mark Canton at Columbia where I took Naomi with me, and usually, you know, if somebody takes a wife or a partner, then they wind up in the outer room chit-chatting with the secretaries, right? So I waved Naomi right in, and we're both sitting there, and a couple other executives come in, and Mark continues chit-chatting. He won't start the meeting, right? He obviously is waiting for Naomi to leave. So I finally broke in, and I said, I think we're ready to begin. You know, Naomi's my partner, and I lean on her for advice, and I've asked her to join me in the meeting. You don't have any objection to that, do you? And, you know, I cold cocked him. It was checkmate. What's he going to say? Yes, I do. You know, I'm not going to allow that. So he said, oh, no, of course not. Of course not. So he went ahead and had the meeting.
But at the same time, you're in a position of having made money with a lot of your scripts, right? And like some sort of emerging or new screenwriter who wants to do this won't necessarily have that kind of privilege.
Oh, I think it's just as easy, because you could always say that that's your writing partner. You know, we work together. And the minute you say that, that person belongs to the meeting.
Gotcha. But then, of course, you have to split the paycheck two ways.
I think that's your own matter, whether you do that or not. Just because you tell the studio that it's your writing partner, when it comes to making out the deal and the contract, no one's going to pay attention to how that's done.
Gotcha. Now, I wanted to actually ask you about one interesting sort of, you know, kind of duality here that's working. I mean, on one hand, you're basically sort of suggesting that if a writer has a screenplay that will make money, that is all you need to make it. You don't need to, like, you know, schmooze. You don't need to do anything along those lines.
What I'm saying is that Hollywood relies so much on greed and functions so completely with greed that if one person reads that script and thinks that they'll make money off of it, that you're going to wind up selling that script, because that one person will either get the financing or go to a studio who has the financing.
But simultaneously, you're also advocating, like, you know, lying and stealing to get to draw attention to this. I was wondering, is there no honest way, really, to sort of get a screenplay sold? Or
I don't understand how I'm advocating lying and stealing. You'll have to explain that.
Well, you mentioned, like, stealing memorabilia. There's the point where you actually have the agent lie and say that another studio, Paramount, has actually, you know, has actually laid down a bid on
the
table.
Well, in terms of stealing the memorabilia, you know, actors for generations have stolen the memorabilia. They take all the memorabilia, including the clothes. I'll give you two instances of it. You know, on an Alan Smithy film, Burn Hollywood Burn, Ryan O'Neill was wearing this beautiful Armani suit. And, of course, there were three of them because sweating and all of that stuff.
Sure.
So Ryan thought that the shoot was over and just took the suits. Arthur Hiller, unfortunately, went up to do another take. So people literally had to discover where Ryan was, you know, and nail him down, tell him to bring the suits back, and we weren't over yet. Otherwise, the suits would have been long gone, and when that final shot was done, the suit was gone. But this happens on almost every movie.
Sure.
And what I'm saying to the screenwriter is, hey, you know, there's no reason why other people should have all the memorabilia. This is yours. You created it. You know, you got to be savvy enough to know that that stuff is going to be taken and gone, so there's no reason why you can't have some of it. It's sort of tongue in cheek. I mean, I don't. This is not one of the huge serious points in the book, and the twisted little guy may have had something to do with this part, you know. But it's relevant in there. In terms of agents lying and cheating on your behalf to bump the price up in an auction or in some situation like that, well, that's what agents do. You know, if an agent really cares about you, you know, I quote my old agent of many years, Guy McElwain, as saying, there's no heart as black as the black heart of an agent. Well, if an agent really cares about you, he will do anything and everything, you know, to help you. And the sign of the true commitment, I think, on an agent's part to you is whether he is in fact willing to lie and cheat and do whatever he can to get you a better price or to get you a better deal. very few agents really do that for screenwriters, because screenwriters are lower down on the totem pole. I'll give you one example of an agent who did. Arnold Rifkin, who was at the head of the William Morris Agency for some time, was my agent, and he was also Bruce Willis's agent. And he sold a script of mine called Blaze of Glory, about Otis Redding, to Universal. And this was a spec script that was done, so it was, and, you know, all they had to do was read it. So the Universal guys read it and said, yes, we'll buy it. But before we buy it, we want to have a creative meeting with Joe. Well, you know, the creative meeting with Joe means we're going to tell him how we want to change it, what we want to do, and how we see it. And then it's sort of a little power play saying, yeah, we'll do you a favor, we'll buy it, but we have our own concerns, right? I don't like dealing with that kind of power play. And I don't like either they want to buy something or not. Not contingent on, you know, on however they feel or I feel. That, you know, I want them to buy it because they think the material's good. So Arnold said to Universal, no, you either buy it or you don't. Universal said, well, if you're going to be that way about it, we're not going to buy it. Arnold said, you know, my client Bruce Willis has just done a movie for you, and he's supposed to do publicity for that movie. And if you want Bruce to do publicity for that movie, then you're not going to make this ridiculous demand with Joe. You're just going to buy his script. And they did, you know. But this is a rare case of an agent, a very rare case of an agent who will actually use another client, a big movie star, to get something done for a client lower down on his scale. And I, you know, completely ethical in a perfect world to do that? Well, Hollywood ain't a perfect world, and it ain't an ethical world, and Arnold did what he had to do, God bless him, and I loved him for it.
I'm just wondering, though, if you could prognosticate upon the possibility of a sort of ethical kind of business decision. I mean, is Hollywood just hopelessly corrupt that the only way to do it is through this kind of chicanery? Or?
Well, without being a complete naive, and the book is called The Devil's Guide. It's not meant for naives. It's meant for people who want to succeed. And who may be tired of being treated and marginalized like second-class citizens. Because Hollywood is amoral, and because it is a world without a whole lot of ethics, the advice in this book essentially says, fight fire with fire. These are the tricks I've learned in 30 years. To either fight or win by trickery, you too can win if you want to. You can preserve your own vision and get it up on screen. It's not going to be easy. But it can be done. And I point to not only my own example, incidentally, in the book in terms of doing that, but I also point to other screenwriters who, through the years, most heroically, Paddy Chayefsky, you know, fought and scratched and clawed and preserved their own vision. That's all it's about. Because essentially the only piece of power that the writer wants is for his vision to be up on screen, undiluted, not mutilated, not in some cases destroyed by director, producer, star, studio.
Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering, though, I mean, in terms of like a vision, you have to battle so many executives and so many lowly production assistants who want to constantly rewrite what you set out to do.
Lowly production assistants can't do that.
Or, I mean, rather lowly like executive people. Sorry, you have the example in the book of the I can't remember which example precisely, but it's the lowly sort of person who basically, one screenwriter basically had to deal with this and then basically just ignored these notes.
Right.
And you urged to fight this particular person and to basically respond to every known form of notes, even from like these people, and CC it to the producer and the director and the like. I'm just wondering, though, I mean, you know, you can't necessarily always win these battles, because essentially it's like one person versus like, you know, 40, hundreds of people who want to tell you what your film is going to be. So, I mean, it's like, how does one, you know, I mean, that's got to tire any kind of screenwriter out.
You're absolutely right. It's tiring. Nobody likes to fight. On the 15 movies that I've had, you know, I think on almost every one there's been some kind of a fight, whether it's been, you know, World War III or just a lesser street brawl. But there's been a fight on almost one, and it's tiring. It certainly tired me out when we moved back from California and we moved to Ohio. That was one of the reasons. because I felt, you know, like a grizzled old warrior in the ring, and it took its own personal toll. You know, I was a functional alcoholic, and the drinking became worse through the years. I've stopped drinking, I've stopped smoking, and I haven't had a drink or a cigarette in 5 years, but I was really burned, and that's one of the reasons we went back. Yeah, it takes a toll. I think the toll would be greater on my view of myself, certainly, excuse me, and on my view of my own writing, had I, you know, truncated, had I followed all the advice I got through the years, you know, and essentially destroyed my own babies. You know, Basic Instinct never would have been a hit movie if I would have followed Michael Douglas's demands and ended the movie with him shooting Sharon and turned the piece into what he called a piece that had reincarnation in it. Only because I made such a public brouhaha out of it, and only because after I made a brouhaha out of it, Paul Verhoeven discovered that he was wrong and apologized for it publicly and held a press conference and said that he hadn't understood what he called the basement of the script, and went back and shot my first draft. Was the movie not changed, that movie would have been destroyed. There, in the case of Jagged Edge, where I got into another endless battle with the studio head, you know, the studio head wanted an ending to the movie where Jeff was innocent, and the movie and the tennis pro did the killings, and the movie ended in a hug between Jeff and Glenn Close. Well, come on, you know, I mean, yeah, that's bad television. Yeah. And I think the reason, you know, whatever you think of the movie or of Basic, one of the reasons that the public loved both and went back to see both over and over again is because they were totally caught off guard with the ending of the movies, you know, and especially with the ambiguity in Jagged Edge.
Well, one might also argue that, you know, Sharon Stone's infamous shot in Basic Instinct was probably a selling point.
It didn't hurt it, but I'm not sure that people go back 4 and 5 times to see little, you know, or itty-bitty little hairs. I mean, yeah. Come on, you know, I mean, we're in a more sophisticated society than that. I think there have been a lot of movies with crotch shots in it, but none that have made $600 million, you know.
Yeah, perhaps that should be, there need to be more movies with crotch shots, I guess.
I think that there have been so many movies done with crotch shots, and so many bad movies, that the market for that kind of movie that dwells on that you know, is pretty well much narrower than it's ever been.
Actually, and that also ties into another remark Paul Verhoeven made. He basically, when Bush became president, that you point
I
this
saw
out.
That.
The book,
what did he say exactly about?
I believe you pointed out that, like, you know, like pornography is dead or something, or titillation is dead now.
He blamed it on Bush.
Yeah, right? He blamed it on Bush.
People blame everything on Bush, you know. So
I was actually having this discussion with my a friend this morning about, like, how NPR is great to wake up because I hear something that Bush has done and I'm instantly galvanized. I actually wanted to talk. I'm not sure if you saw Joe Queenan's review of this book in the New York Times Book Review.
I did.
Yeah, but he took you to task for noting how you vetted and created Sharon Stone. He said, oh, well, you know, this is a guy who writes, you know, a screenplay about, you know, a welder who becomes a dancer. I was wondering, you know, why did you go ahead and was this part of the Little Man Act? But why boast about these kinds of conquests like this? Are these details germane when you're discussing how to actually sell the screenplay?
When I point out all the different screenwriters that have betted the stars, and there's a long history of this, I think I do it as encouragement for screenwriters to keep writing. Mm-hmm. There are perks. And that's one of the perks.
It outweighs the fight.
There are perks. Yeah. There are perks to being a screenwriter. My suspicion with Queenan is that Queenan made much more of it than I do, mm-hmm. you know, in that article. And maybe he should meet Sharon. I don't know, you know. But he really kept going back to this Sharon and that and Sharon over and over again.
Well, you did the whole Basic Instinct anecdote of, you know, the crew urinating into the...
No, that wasn't...
Oh, I'm sorry,
that
Sliver,
wasn't,
I'm sorry.
No, that yeah. wasn't Sliver either. It was a movie called Alan Quarterman and the Lost, whatever it was.
Alan, the Lost.
Yeah, incidentally, I'm not the first person to reveal that anecdote. but I thought it was relevant in terms of describing a certain kind of star behavior that's out there. That, you know, a star behavior that can be so arrogant and self-absorbed that a crew decides to do that in a bathtub before the star gets into it. There's a chapter on stars in the book, as there is a chapter on critics, as there is a chapter on directors. And then in the stars chapter, you know, I think one of the things that happens that I've certainly seen is the kind of self-absorbed, narcissistic behavior where they really view themselves as above ordinary human beings. They do feel themselves to be American aristocracy, or aristocracy in a democracy. You know, and some of the behavior is so outrageous that some don't allow eye contact with people on the set. You know, I think what I'm saying is, come on, you know, you're a human, your shorts have skid marks too, you know, let's not go crazy here, you know, about taking ourselves so seriously. And that anecdote was relevant in terms of telling that story.
Gotcha. I actually wanted to ask you, tying this into the Joe Queen interview, but Brian Curtis he basically took Hollywood Animal at Slate, basically summarized the best bits and urged people not to buy it. There's this perception.
Who is Brian Curtis?
He's a critic for Slate.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, but he basically took Hollywood Animal and said, these are the best bits and you don't need to buy this. And there seems to be a strange kind of, like, you know, people, at least a lot of these critics, don't really want to take you seriously. How can you get a message across in a book when you have people like Curtis and Queenan out there who are...
In terms of Hollywood Animal, you know, I also got the kind of review from, like, Richard Schickel, who said that this is one of the best books he'd ever read. That it's a mesmerizing book that he followed from one page to the next. Look, in this book, there is a chapter about critics that says they want to rob you, rape your wife, and eat your children. I'm not surprised at the critical response. I mean, you know, that when I have a chapter like that in the book, I'm sort of asking for it. But no one's really going after critics. You know, I mean, after all these years of listening to criticism, I got my shot, you know, to take my punches, and I do it happily, and I really enjoyed it. And what I say about them, I think, is very true. It's about time someone said it, and even Queenan in his review did say that this was a brutally honest book and an uncompromisingly ethical book. So that means I must have been telling the truth in this chapter about the critics, don't you think?
Yeah, I suppose, perhaps, yeah. I wanted to actually... Oh, yeah. Well, I actually, if you'd like, I'd like to, if you could entertain this, I'd actually like to read something to you, which sure. You will probably remember. And I was actually astonished to discover this. But right after the sun comes up, first thing folks do around Harrisonville, Missouri, is go up to the barn and see if the mare is still there. Horse thieves drive around the gravel roads and brushy hills and tractor trailers looking to rustle lazy-bone nags. Then they grind them up into bags of meat jelly for the dog food people. And now this is the opening lines for...
Charlie Simpson's Apocalypse, that's
yes.
Right.
And I'm wondering, you know, I tried to look for this book everywhere, and I couldn't find it. And I also note that in this book, and in also the paperback editions I have of your other books, you don't actually list the other books that you have written.
I do in the Knopf books.
Okay.
For whatever reason, St. Martin's policy was not to list the other books, although I noticed they referred to Hollywood Animal and American Rhapsody is New York Times bestsellers.
I'm curious about, you know, Charlie Simpson's Apocalypse and whether, do you think you can go back to writing along these lines? Or
look, I think Hollywood Animal, I don't know if you've read the book, but in terms of its, in terms of descriptive sequences, you know, has passages like that. So does American Rhapsody. Bill Buckley reviewed, him have Buckley reviewed it and said he thought it was one of the most lyrical books about Clinton and about American politics ever written. This isn't that kind of book. You know, this is an anti-textbook. In some ways, it's a spoof. I wanted to give my lyrical powers a rest. If you do an anti-textbook, you want to make it very accessible. It's the kind of book that you don't have to read from page one to the last page. And it's fun. It's funny. You know, so the aspects of this are totally different than some of the other things that I've written.
I'm just wondering, though, I mean, you know, there's a part of you that does things like Charlie Simpson and the Telling Lies in America and the like, and there's a part of you, again, going back to the little man that we were talking about earlier, that does Showgirls and Basic Instinct and Sliver and Jade. And I'm wondering if you know, you could actually even ditch the little man at any point, or is this essential for you as a writer to
I love him way too much. I'm too attached to him, and... and I truly love him, and he's always been with me. He's my pal. Sometimes he takes a rest, you know, and sometimes he feels like he wants to get back into the action, and I can't ever gauge when he wants to rest and when he doesn't, and there are some books where both elements are there. I think we all write different things with different tones, with different subjects. The tone is determined by the subject to a great extent. Charlie Simpson was an American tragedy, and it symbolized the kind of polarization that was eating the country up at the time. It had an elegiac quality to it, and I think the prose matched it, and I think that may be why it was nominated for the National Book Award. When I was writing about American Rhapsody and the most famous blowjob in history and Bill Clinton and that whole crazed world of American politics, because one of the things I tried to do was put the Clinton thing in context with a whole bunch of other pieces of political insanity that had happened, even to the point of going off and doing fictionalized rips in the piece itself, you know, and ending the whole book, you know, with this crazed thing of Willard, which was Clinton's name for his penis talking.
Yeah.
I think those events demanded that kind of tone. And Hollywood Animal had an entirely different tone, I think, because it not only was my Hollywood career, but it was my childhood, and more than anything else, the spine of the book was my relationship with my father, which was very difficult and complex and had to do with some very serious things. And of course, the final part of the book was cancer and not writing for 2 years and completely changing my life and going back to Ohio. And I think, you know, that's a 760-page book, but the tone of it, once again, is completely different. To write about screenwriting, I didn't want to do what McKee and Sid Field and so many others do, and then by writing these abstract and somewhat pompous, because they're not really writers, and phony books that have to do with dramatic theory and arcs, you know, and various theories about screenwriting that have been espoused, you know, from the 30s on. I wanted to do a book that's real, that's about what screenwriting really is, in the world that it happens in. And at the same time, I wanted it to be illuminating, but also inspiring to would-be screenwriters, to show them that they don't necessarily have to lose. They don't have to be yet one more of those horrendous nightmare stories told about what happens to screenwriters, that there have been exceptions to that, not just me, but Chayefsky and Ellison and other people at different times, Bob Town, and all of those little all-hail sequences that detail those incidents in those movies where those things happen.
I'm just curious if you have ever regretted any of the sort of, like, you know, the fact that you've made a good deal of money through all of your films, and why you didn't just, like, cash in your chips and do, like, more independent stuff like Telling Lies in America.
Well, I did it. I did Telling Lies, and I did an Alan Smithy film, both of which were small independent projects. I did a little movie called Big Shots about kids, and the possibility of a friendship between a white kid and a black kid. Some of the big commercial stuff that I've done, I would argue with you, like Betrayed and Music Box, are much more independent movies than they are studio movies. They just happen to be made by United Artists. The movies you're really talking about, the big studio things, are probably Jagged Edge and Flashdance and Basic Instinct, Sliver, Jade, and Showgirls. I like pushing buttons. I'm a provocateur, you know. I mean, I don't think that's probably a mix between the Twisted Little Man and me. I liked pushing the Showgirls button, watching everybody go screaming batshit, you know, whether it was the religious right or the feminist left, and I took some enjoyment out of seeing all the fireworks that happened after that. You know, the last movie that I did is a very much of an independent picture. It's a movie called Children of Glory, which was made about the Hungarian Revolution for, I think, a $7 million budget in Hungary. It's produced by Andy Vajna, who produced the Terminator movies and also produced both Music Box and an Alan Smithy film. And it's about the Hungarian Revolution of 1956, where the Hungarian people drive the Russian soldiers out with sticks and stones and bottles in their hands and for 5 days, and then the Russians come back in and decimate the country. It will be in the film festivals next year. We will distribute it in this country. We have 3 distributors vying for it. That's about as an independent picture as you can get, you know. So, I think I've worked both ways. And I've certainly enjoyed working on both levels. But the flip side of it has been that it's certainly been a tiring process. One of the great advantages to me of writing books is that I have an editor who gives me suggestions, right? And I can take those suggestions or not. And if I decide not to, they're not going to bring in another writer or 5 others and blow the brains out of what it is that I've written. That's I find a really civilized way to work. I haven't had any fights on any of my books, and it's, you know, brought a certain kind of a piece to my life that wasn't there through all the studio things. I'm finishing a novel called The Fun, that I've been working on for about 4 years. That I'm excited about. So, you know, there are a lot of benefits to continuing writing books. But I think probably one of these days I'm going to sit down and write some thriller that's going to really piss people off all over again for whatever reason, and we'll see what happens.
Is there any kind of point of convergence between the little deviant man and the...
He's not a deviant, he's a twisted little man.
Twisted little man, okay.
That's right.
The twisted little man and this kind of... The Joe Esterhaus that writes this novel, or Charlie Simpson. Is there sort of... Where do you feel the convergence?
Well, the novel, a novel is somewhere in between the two things, because I think some people some of my critics will be very upset with the novel. On the other hand, I think that it will be a powerful book. I don't know where that line is. I have no idea.
Joe, thanks so much.
Thank you. Thanks. Good questions. Really good questions. Thank you.
Sure. Thanks.